This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Facts and Fears, Hard Truths from a Life in Intelligence by James R. Clapper with Trey Brown. Read for you by Mark Bramhall. To the men and women of the intelligence community who keep this nation safe and secure, and to Sue, who was always there for me. Introduction. Beyond Their Wildest Imagination. As one of more than 40 million Americans who'd already cast an absentee ballot for the 2016 presidential election, I was in Muscat, Oman, on almost certainly my last whirlwind trip to meet with Middle East leaders as U.S. Director of National Intelligence, when the electorate went to the polls on November 8th. Oman is 9 hours ahead of Washington, and before I went to bed that night about 2 a.m. in Oman and 5 p.m. on the U.S. East Coast, election analysts and pundits were discussing how the Republican candidate for president, Donald Trump, had a narrow path to win the election, but only if a long list of specific states improbably broke his way. They predicted that as soon as Florida or Ohio was called for former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the election would effectively be over. I slept 4 or 5 hours, rose, and turned on the TV, discovering that the narrative had flipped. The media analysts had called Ohio for Trump and said Clinton needed massive turnouts in all the left-leaning cities in Florida that hadn't reported yet for her to have a chance of taking the state's 29 Electoral College votes. I was surprised, but didn't really have time to think about it. I read the overnight intelligence reports and continued getting ready for the day. An hour later, the media called Florida for Trump and laid out a very specific list of states that would now all have to swing to Clinton for her to win. As the morning progressed, I worked through the back-to-back meetings that were typical of foreign trips. In the short breaks between them, my staff updated me on how things stood with the election. As we broke for lunch at 2:31 a.m. on the U.S. East Coast, the Associated Press declared Trump to be the U.S. president-elect. I was shocked. Everyone was shocked, including Mr. Trump, who'd continued on Election Day to cast doubt on whether he would accept the election results as legitimate. Having a few minutes alone, I kept thinking of just how out of touch I was with the people who lived in Middle America. I'd been stationed in heartland states repeatedly during my military career, particularly Texas, and I had traveled extensively as an agency director in the early 2000s, and again during the past 6.5 years as Director of National Intelligence, DNI, meeting with intelligence community employees outside of St. Louis, speaking at the University of Texas at Austin, and with the Chamber of Commerce in San Antonio, and visiting many other places. I'd joked to audiences about just how out of touch people in Washington were, and I'd never failed to draw a laugh, sometimes applause. Working down in the engine room of our national security enterprise, shoveling intelligence coal, as I like to say, I never recognized just how much frustration with and resentment toward Washington those communities had, and just how deep the roots of their anger went. But Donald Trump had, and he'd appealed to them more than I'd realized or liked. I also thought about the warning on Russian interference in the election that Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson and I had issued to the American public a month earlier. We'd agonized over the precise wording of the press release and whether naming Russian President Vladimir Putin as the mastermind and puppeteer of the Russian influence operation would cause an international incident, drawing Jay's department and the intelligence community into the political fray. Reading responses to exit polls, I realized that our release and public statements simply hadn't mattered. I wasn't sure if people were oblivious to the seriousness of the threat we'd described, or if they just didn't care what the Russians were doing. Either way, I saw that our efforts ended up having all the impact of another raindrop in a storm at sea. I wondered what President Obama was thinking, and if he regretted his reticence to put his thumb on the scale of the election, as he put it. By not publicly calling out the Russian interference, while Putin was effectively standing on the other end of that scale. At the same time, I was no longer sure it would have mattered to the people in Middle America if the president had presented everything we knew about Russia's massive cyber and propaganda efforts to undermine American democracy, disparage former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and promote Donald Trump. Despite the public narrative that Edward Snowden had disingenuously started in 2013, alleging we were spying on everyday U.S. citizens, the intelligence community, IC, had no authority and no capability to evaluate how Americans were receiving the Russian propaganda or what they were thinking and doing when they entered polling booths. In a lot of ways, our capabilities were like the physical infrastructure at the signals intelligence facilities in Ukraine I'd visited in 1991, after the Iron Curtain fell. Just like the former Soviet antenna arrays had been, our capabilities were oriented outward toward the threat and largely incapable of looking inward, even if we wanted to. It simply wasn't our job. We'd been watching how the Russians were trying to influence U.S. voters, not what impact they may have been having. We had no empirical evidence to assess whether the Russian influence campaign was working, and on Election Day, I was disturbed to recognize it probably had. I didn't realize it then, but the Russians were just as shocked as we were. They'd succeeded beyond their wildest imagination and were completely unprepared for their own success. The Russian propaganda network in the United States, formerly known as Russia Today and since rebranded as just RT, was jubilant in calling the election for Mr. Trump. "That's what this is, a defining moment in global history, that America is willing to turn the page and possibly isolate itself from the rest of the world," they declared. "The next speech that Donald Trump gives to the world will be one of the most important speeches in the history of the world." As the anchors reveled in Trump's victory, the crawl at the bottom of the screen continued running lines intended to delegitimize Clinton's win, such as, "Several states report broken voting machines." The Russian internet troll factory scrambled to stop its hashtag DemocracyRIP social media campaign, set to run from its fake accounts on Twitter and Facebook. In the middle of all this, Putin lost the chance to return the favor of challenging Clinton's victory, as she'd challenged the results of the 2011 Russian election when she'd been U.S. Secretary of State. I don't believe he minded at all. After the election, the CIA and the FBI continued to uncover evidence of pre-election Russian propaganda, all intended to undermine Clinton and promote Trump, and the intelligence community continued to find indications of Russian cyber operations to interfere with the election. At a National Security Council meeting on Monday, December 5th, President Obama gave us more explicit instructions. He wanted the CIA, NSA, and FBI, each agency with the mission-specific tradecraft and capabilities to determine what the Russians had done, to assemble all their findings, encompassing the most sensitive sourcing, into a single report that he could pass on to the next administration and to Congress. He also asked us to produce a paper for public consumption with as much information from the classified version as possible. And, critically, he wanted all of this done before he left office. The highly classified IC assessment that resulted was, I believe, a landmark product, among the most important ever produced by U.S. intelligence. I was proud of our work, but the unclassified version we published ran just a few pages and was written with the clinical sterility of a standard intelligence briefing. I still wanted to more fully capture what it felt like to be on the receiving end of the Russian influence operation in 2015 and 2016. For me, there was no specific moment in that time, no flash of insight, when I understood that our primary adversary for nearly all of my half-century as a U.S. intelligence professional was, without exaggeration, hacking away at the very roots of our democracy. That realization slowly washed over me in 2016 in a tide that continued to rise after the election, and even after I'd left government and the new administration had transitioned into power. My concern about what I saw taking place in America, and my apprehension that we were losing focus on what the Russians had done to us, is ultimately what persuaded me to write this book, to use what we had learned in our IC assessment to frame my experience and our collective experience as Americans. My hope is to capture and share the experience of more than 50 years in the intelligence profession, to impart the pride that intelligence officers take in their work, the care with which they consider the ethical implications of surveillance and espionage, and the patriotism and willingness to sacrifice that they bring to the job. And finally, I intend to show that what Russia did to the United States during the 2016 election was far worse than just another post-Cold War jab at an old adversary. What happened to us was a sustained assault on our traditional values and institutions of governance, from external as well as internal pressures. In the wake of that experience, my fear is that many Americans are questioning if facts are even knowable. As foreign adversaries and our national leaders continue to deny objective reality while advancing their own alternative facts. America possesses great strength and resilience, but how we rise to this challenge, with clear-eyed recognition of the unbiased facts and setting aside our doubts, is entirely up to us. I believe the destiny of the American ideal is at stake. Chapter 1. Born into the Intelligence Business. When I accepted President Obama's offer to be the Director of National Intelligence, I was pushing 70 years old. Today, of course, I'm dragging it closer and closer to 80. One reason that's significant is because both the earliest notions of a U.S. intelligence community and the menace of the Soviet threat to the West were born about the same time as I was. My father was drafted into the Army in 1944, when I was 3 years old. As a signals intelligence officer during the war, he supported intercepting Japanese and German communications used to help the Allies win the war. He became deeply committed to the mission and respected the people he worked with. And before the ink was dry on the Japanese instrument of unconditional surrender, he'd decided to stay in the Army while most everyone else was demobilizing and shedding the uniform. Growing up and moving around from one signals intelligence site to another, I learned from a very early age to never, never talk about what my dad did. I think my parents would be shocked, and my mother also mildly amused, that after retiring from the intelligence profession in 2017, I'd try to publicly explain what the intelligence community, the IC, is, what it does, and what it should stand for. For me, this 7-decade-and-more journey started with a bang, and not a good one. My earliest vivid memory is of my mother and me entering the port of Livorno, Italy, in 1946, on our way to meet my dad in Eritrea on the Horn of Africa. We were among the first U.S. dependents to cross the Atlantic after the war, a trip my mother portrayed as a big adventure, I'm sure to calm her own apprehensions as much as mine. U.S. forces had liberated the city of Livorno from the Germans in 1944 and still occupied it and controlled the harbor. But post-war Italy wasn't precisely safe for U.S. dependents, or really for anyone. As our troop ship, the USS Fred T. Berry, entered the harbor, I heard and felt an explosion, and the ship went dead in the water. Its alarm bells started ringing, 3 rings and a pause, and then repeated. I can still hear the shrill sound, and we rushed topside. Huddling on the deck, I felt my mother gripping the back of my far-too-big life preserver and watched as lifeboats were lowered over the side. She told me years later that the crew had barely kept the ship from sinking. As we were towed into port, the mast tops of sunken ships slowly passed to either side, looking every bit like crosses in a graveyard for vessels not as fortunate as ours. We spent a couple of weeks in Livorno while the rudder was repaired, and then continued on our voyage to Africa. In Alexandria, my dad bribed the harbor pilot with a carton of cigarettes to take him out to meet us as our ship made its way into port. I don't recall arriving in Egypt, but my second vivid childhood memory is of leaving, my mother shaking me from sleep in a hotel in Cairo, while my dad quickly packed our bags. She told me, calmly but urgently, that we had to go to Payne Field, Cairo's airport, and leave the country immediately. I was barely awake as we raced to board an airplane. The family legend is that King Farouk had met them that night in the hotel bar, which must have seemed like amazing luck, at least until the king made a pass at my mother. My dad tried to punch him, and we all had to depart in a hurry. It's not good to take a swing at the king. It took 8 weeks for my mother and me to travel from Fort Wayne, Indiana, to the primitive but very pretty city of Asmara, Eritrea, which sat atop a 7,500-foot-high plateau. Today, Eritrea is a small, independent, and largely forgotten nation on the Red Sea, bordering the African powerhouses of Ethiopia and Sudan. Before the war, it had been in the Italian colony of Abyssinia, but when I arrived in 1946, it was part of Ethiopia, and the long war resulting in Eritrean independence was still a few years off. The locals viewed Americans with reverence. In their eyes, we were rich and powerful, even though we lived in a converted barracks building on a former Italian Navy communications station. I made friends both with the local kids and a few other army brats and learned Italian to fluency, but of course have forgotten it all since. One day a friend and I were playing in the army salvage dump, which was off limits, but there was so much cool military equipment left over from the war, it was hard to stay away. I picked up a glass vial and dumped out what appeared to be rainwater, but was in fact sulfuric acid, which ran down my left leg. I knew I was in trouble when part of my pants began to disappear and my leg started steaming. I ran home, scared to death. The Asmara doctor, one of only 7 officers on the post, had just stopped by our quarters, and he and my mother dumped me in the bathtub, emptying a 10-pound bag of baking soda my mother had just bought at the commissary onto me, which was exactly the right emergency procedure. My recovery took months and involved a lot of painful skin grafts, and my dad never forgave himself since he was the logistics officer responsible for the dump. My accident convinced them that remote stations might not have adequate medical care for small children prone to self-inflicted disasters. And so, in 1948, when I was 7 and my parents learned my mother was pregnant, they decided it was time to return to the States. Some 43 years later, when I was director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, I visited Asmara and walked around the compound, which was by then an abandoned Eritrean army post. I was amazed how dinky it seemed compared to the huge complex I remembered, but it was unmistakably the same place. I found the foundation footings of what had been our quarters, and the original Italian Navy communications towers were still there. My memories of the trip back to the United States are as vivid as those of the trip to Eritrea. We flew out on Ethiopian Airlines, which consisted of a few olive drab B-17s with EAL printed on their tails. Our pilot, Bailout Wicker, told us he got his name because he'd parachuted out of more than one B-17 during the war. That did not inspire confidence in 7-year-old Jimmy Clapper, but thankfully we encountered no emergencies on our flight. I will never forget sitting in the nose bubble, which still had its machine gun mount, and flying into Payne Field, where planes abandoned after the war were parked in the desert as far as the eye could see. Fighters, bombers, transport planes, all baking in the sun. From Cairo, we flew to Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, and stayed 5 days waiting for a plane to Germany. I remember standing outside our motel in short pants as the blowing sand stung my legs. We flew on a big, slow C-54, a redesignated DC-4, from Dhahran to Frankfurt, which was still in rubble, with people everywhere begging for handouts. We stayed overnight in Bad Sudan, outside the city, with no potable water, and I recall being very thirsty. From Frankfurt, we spent a day and a half on a train to Bremerhaven, single-tracking the whole way, and passing mile after mile of abandoned or destroyed rolling stock, locomotives, tankers, passenger cars, and freight cars. In retrospect, Germany's recovery from the war is a remarkable achievement. Finally, we sailed back to the United States on another converted troop ship. My dad was assigned to Vint Hill Farms Station in Virginia, which was at the time an Army Signals Intelligence Post outside Washington. I was a huge fan of Superman and Batman, and I had a large collection of their comics, which I kept in strict chronological order and took very good care of. They'd be worth a fortune today. But when we had to relocate again, there were strict weight limits for transporting household goods, and my parents didn't want to use up their allowance with a lot of comic books. I was told we had to leave them behind, and so, with much regret, I handed over my entire pristine condition collection to a bratty 4-year-old girl named Sue. 17 years later, after many more moves for both of us, I married Sue, despite the fact that she no longer had my comics. I wasn't aware of it, but that was a tough move for my parents, too, as we were forced to separate for a while. In 1950, after the North Koreans invaded South Korea, my dad was sent to Shitose, Japan, as the second-in-command of a small Army Signals Intelligence Unit supporting the war effort. Shitose is on Hokkaido, the second-largest, northernmost, and least populated of Japan's 4 main islands. It's just across the Sea of Japan, and on about the same latitude as Vladivostok, Russia. Because we couldn't join him until suitable facilities for dependents were built, my mother, sister, and I returned to Fort Wayne, living with my grandparents on their 160 acres, while I was in fourth grade and part of fifth, before we joined my dad near the end of 1951. Regular Army soldiers viewed the signals intelligence guys in the Army Security Agency as having more brains than brawn, and more of an affinity for electronics than shooting, fighting, and sleeping on the ground. But in Shitose, every now and then, the commanding officer and my dad wanted to remind the troops they were part of the Army, and so they'd take the signals intelligence unit to the field and practice putting up tents, operating a field mess, and doing weapons proficiency training. My dad took me along on one of these summer encampments, equipped with cut-down fatigues, a web belt, a canteen, the smallest helmet liner my dad could find, and even a small backpack. The first sergeant, the senior enlisted man in the unit, took a shine to me and let me carry his unloaded M1 rifle, or maybe he saw me as a convenient way to get out of having to carry it himself. Either way, it was a cool experience for an 11-year-old, and undoubtedly something that can't be done in today's Army, even on Bring Your Child to Work Day. I was enamored with the little I knew of my dad's work, and I was learning a lot about soldiering from watching him. But it was something my mother did in Shitose in 1952 that had a lifelong impact on how I viewed the world. This was before the Supreme Court's 1954 Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka ruling that desegregated schools in the states, but it was 4 years after President Truman signed Executive Order 9981, banning racial discrimination in the military. The executive order may have desegregated the armed forces institutionally, but not socially. Much of the social life on military bases, particularly overseas, and certainly on the remote base in Shitose, was centered on the officers' club. On Sundays, the club always served a fancy brunch, putting out its best linen and china and hiring a Japanese band to play and sing its amusing interpretations of popular American songs. The officers, including my dad, who was then a captain, wore dress uniforms, while their wives were in their Sunday best, complete with hats and white gloves. Even the kids dressed up, which for me was torture. At my age, I didn't know and didn't care about who the senior officers in the club were. I didn't know the colonels and lieutenant colonels. But one Sunday, I recognized my dentist, who was a first lieutenant, a junior army officer like my dad, and one of the very few black Army officers on the base. On that day, my family had a prime table near the band, but when my dentist came in, he took a seat by himself on the perimeter of the room. I noticed him there, but didn't think much of it. When the music stopped, my mother, and I'm sure she picked this timing on purpose, stood up and rather ostentatiously walked over to my dentist's table. Many of the officers and their wives in the room noticed and pointedly watched her. She talked with him for a minute or two, invited him to sit with us, took him by the hand, and led him through the center of the room to our table. As she did, all the senior officers began staring at my dad, their faces projecting their unspoken questions. "What is your wife doing? Can't you get her under control?" I'll never forget my dad's expression, a mixture of amusement, admiration, and fear. But to his great credit, he made my sister and me shift our chairs to make room at the table for our guest. There may have been consequences for my parents, although if there were, they never mentioned them. In fact, my mother never said a word about what she'd done, even though she spoke to me about a lot of other things, sometimes incessantly. That may be why I remember that Sunday brunch so vividly, even though it was more than 65 years ago. At a very impressionable age, my mother showed me that the color of someone's skin doesn't determine the human dignity they deserve. That lesson stayed with me and influenced decisions I've made in both my personal and professional lives. When my family left Japan in 1953, en route to Littleton, Massachusetts, my sister and I were parked with my mother's parents in Philadelphia. This was a good deal for me because my grandparents let me stay up as late as I wanted to watch TV. Television was a great novelty, since we didn't have one in Japan. On Friday nights, the old movies would end about 12:30, and one night I did the 1950s equivalent of channel surfing, which required actually walking up to the set and manually turning the selector dial. There were only four channels, and one night I stopped between channels 4 and 5. I'll never forget this, because I heard voices speaking in a clipped cadence. There was no picture, just voices. I listened for maybe 15 minutes as they batted words and numbers back and forth in speech patterns bordering on the nonsensical. Finally, I figured out that I'd stumbled onto the broadcast frequency of the Philadelphia Police Department dispatcher. I wanted to hear more, but my arm was getting tired, so I went to the kitchen, found some toothpicks, and stuck them in the dial to secure it. That's right. I hacked the Philadelphia Police Department using my grandparents' black-and-white TV set and some toothpicks. The next night, I was prepared with a map of the city of Philadelphia and began plotting the addresses where the police cruisers were dispatched. After a few nighttime surveillance sessions, I figured out where the police district boundaries were, based on which cruisers responded to specific locations. I wrote down anything they said that I didn't understand, and kept listening until I had figured out what all the 10 codes, 10-4, 10-5, etc., were, the system for call signs, and the personal identifiers for lieutenants and above. I got a pack of index cards to keep track of all the facts I was collecting. Soon I was staying up every night to build my database. About a month later, when my parents came to Philadelphia to retrieve my sister and me, my dad asked, "So, what have you been up to this summer?" I showed him my map and my card files, and I gave him a thorough briefing on how police operations worked in the city. I'll never forget the expression on his face as he exclaimed, "My God, I've raised my own replacement." One evening in the fall of 2015, when I was the Director of National Intelligence, I was shooting the breeze with my staff and recounted this story. A few weeks later, my speechwriter put it into the script for a speech I was scheduled to give for a CIA-sponsored event at George Washington University on the ethos and the profession of intelligence. I hadn't seriously considered it before, but this vignette from my childhood illustrates what we do in the intelligence profession in simple terms. Intelligence involves research, determination, persistence, patience, continuity, drawing inferences in the absence of complete information, and taking advantage of vulnerabilities and what you overhear in others' conversations, no matter how cryptic and jargon-filled they are. Obviously, the Philadelphia Police Department hadn't foreseen that a 12-year-old kid would listen in on its radio transmissions, let alone map out its operations. I didn't realize it at the time, but that little avocation, more than 60 years ago, started me down the path to service in the intelligence business. My family spent most of my seventh grade year in Littleton while my dad completed the Army Security Agency Officer's career course at Fort Devens. We lived in an old farmhouse on 85 acres with lots of berries to pick. By 1953, when my sister was old enough to start elementary school and I was getting close to starting high school, my parents made plans to settle down in Virginia near the Army Security Agency headquarters in Arlington. It was going to be a struggle on an Army captain's salary, but they decided to buy a small house in the expensive Washington suburb of Falls Church, Virginia, which would enable me to attend the new Annandale High School. I finished the seventh grade being bused to a dilapidated wreck of an elementary school near Bailey's Crossroads called the Woodburn Annex. My only distinct memory of that spring was our seventh grade field trip to New York, when we got to fly on a Lockheed Super Constellation. For me, that plane was the pinnacle of speed and luxury, and the only thing it was missing was a nose bubble with a machine gun mount. As planned, I enrolled at Annandale High School as an eighth grader when its doors first opened to students in the fall of 1954, the year of the U.S. Supreme Court decision to desegregate schools, an unpopular ruling in Virginia. When our neighboring Arlington County attempted to observe the ruling, the state government fired its school board and took direct control of enrollments statewide. I don't know what would have happened if Fairfax County, where we lived, had been left to its own devices, but with the state in control, Annandale High remained segregated through my 4 years there. I wasn't involved in segregation protests or anything radical, but I often thought about what my mother had done for my dentist in Chitose. Meanwhile, things weren't going quite as planned for my dad. After a series of reorganizations involving the three service cryptologic commands, the Army Security Agency, the Air Force Security Service, and the Naval Security Group, he found himself attached to the headquarters unit of a new intelligence organization, the National Security Agency. And when in 1955 NSA began its move from Arlington Hall to Fort Meade, south of Baltimore, Maryland, he was among the first reassigned. My parents decided to stay in Falls Church, and my dad had to spend several hours on the road every day, all so I could remain in my high school. This had to be particularly frustrating because my brother, Mike, had just joined our family. Mike was born at Fort Belvoir 7 years after my sister, Ruth Ann, was born at Walter Reed 7 years after I came into the world. When I was old enough to drive, my dad bought me a 1947 Cadillac convertible. I think he intentionally picked a car that weighed over 2 tons and got 9 miles to the gallon, so I couldn't go very far with it. It was broken most of the time anyway, and we spent many weekends together working on it and bonding. I still keep a model of that car, and it always reminds me of Dad and our grease monkey Saturday afternoons together. By my junior year, I was working as a janitor at our church and over the summer as a lifeguard at our neighborhood pool. And I was terribly in love, as only a 17-year-old can be. Then, in early 1958, my dad was unexpectedly reassigned to Germany. I'm sure this was stressful for my parents, but for me it was a Shakespearean tragedy. I announced that I wasn't going, and that I had made arrangements to live in a friend's basement for the summer and my senior year. My mother then did a brave thing. She sold our house and traveled to Germany with my sister and brother to join my dad without me. I lasted about 6 weeks before I wrote a letter asking them to send my orders so that I could rejoin the family in Germany. That was a hugely disappointing moment for me to admit I couldn't manage life by myself and to leave Virginia. Life can sometimes loop back on itself, and in 2013, when I was the DNI, Annandale High asked me to be its graduation speaker, 59 years later. The ceremony fell on June 13th, and when I accepted the invitation, I had no idea how difficult that week would be for me. It was 2.5 months after damaging mandatory budget cuts went into effect for the intelligence community, and I was fighting the Defense Department to keep intelligence professionals from being furloughed. It was 3 weeks after Edward Snowden had fled to Hong Kong and stolen documents were leaking out through press outlets, cutting into intelligence capabilities on a daily basis. I thought about canceling, but was glad I didn't. The students were in high spirits, and they also made me laugh when I arrived. Rather than donning the gown commensurate with my master's degree, the students asked me to wear the same one they were wearing, to indicate that, like them, I had yet to graduate from Annandale High. I was game, and I did. I took about 2 minutes of my commencement speech to vent before talking about the graduating class, their accomplishments, and what lay ahead for them. I closed my speech that night by telling them, "If you take care of yourself, if you have a vision of what you want for the future, if you're kind and attentive and responsible, I can pretty much guarantee that you'll live an interesting and successful life. That doesn't necessarily mean you'll reach every goal you set out to achieve. 59 years ago, I set out to graduate from Annandale High, and I didn't reach that goal. I never got the chance to wear a red Annandale robe and mortarboard until tonight. And it's okay to fall short of some of your goals, even if it feels like a disaster at the time. You'll most likely do some pretty cool other things, as long as you do your best to stay on the right path. I'm proud of how things have turned out in my life, and I've never, ever been bored. Although these days I'd like a little boredom. Sometimes, by some circuitous route, you eventually reach those goals you thought had long passed you by. So, tonight I get to wear Annandale red. And you know it feels pretty sweet." Back in the summer of 1958, leaving Virginia for Germany with my tail tucked between my legs, the feeling was not pretty sweet. I took a ship to Bremerhaven and a train to Nuremberg, where my parents met me and drove me the last few miles to Herzog Base, less than 50 miles from the East German border, where my dad was the operations officer of an Army Signals Intelligence Battalion. His group was part of an enormous effort to intercept communications between the newly formed Warsaw Pact nations, the Soviet Union and 7 satellite countries in Eastern Europe. My dad had a knack for being posted in places just in time for a flashpoint, and I had just barely arrived when Nikita Khrushchev delivered his November speech with an ultimatum to remove all Western forces from West Berlin in 6 months or risk war. President Eisenhower maintained American troops in West Berlin, and he kept the number of service members stationed in West Germany at 250,000, plus their dependents. I fell into an easy routine with all the other Army brats at Nuremberg American High School. We were a tiny school and had just enough male bodies to form a football team to play against other dependent American high schools. I played guard on both offense and defense, not a natural position for me at 160 pounds, and I soon got over leaving my love interest behind in Virginia. The recent history of Nuremberg was intensely omnipresent, and I remember touring the courtroom where the International Military Tribunal had been held just 13 years before. Here, the Holocaust was not something you just read about in a textbook, and discussions of the atrocities humans are capable of committing were not academic. I think that for all of us, it put the work our parents were doing to counter the Soviets in a sobering light. That year, I befriended 2 soldiers stationed at Herzog Base, ostensibly working for my dad, who were licensed amateur ham radio operators. Because high-frequency radio carried over great distances, the military in those days sanctioned hams as an alternative way of communicating with family and friends back in the States. Cooperating hams in America could connect with overseas radio operators via phone and save them a ton of money in overseas phone charges. It was all fascinating to me, so I hung out with these two soldiers, both of whom had college degrees and were really good guys. They taught me about communications theory and practice and about the propagation effects of weather, time of day, and seasons of the year, especially in the high-frequency band of the radio frequency spectrum. That primer was a good foundation years later, since HF was the communications mainstay for the Soviets and Chinese during the Cold War. More important to me at the time was the fact that I had a chance to encounter the caliber of people who were in the same profession as my dad. They were not at all interested in the Army as a career, but they were conscientious and professional about their duties, and they stressed that if I was going to join the military, I should do so as a commissioned officer. I was impressed, and the idea of service was growing on me. By the summer of 1959, I was ready to venture out on my own. I graduated from the American school as co-valedictorian and enrolled at the University of Maryland in Munich, a small college campus for dependent sons and daughters on the McGraw-Casern military installation, with enough course offerings for 2 years of college. My roommate there was a guy named Mike Leonard, who'd been a classmate in Nuremberg. We both wanted to be Army officers and thought Munich gave us the best chance to secure appointments to one of the service academies the following year. It was a great place to be a college student. I drank a lot of beer, and riding the trolley to the clubs and beer sinks in Schwabing, learned enough Gasthaus German to take advantage of what the city had to offer. Mike and I were studying Russian, and that fall we got the bright idea to take the train to Berlin to spend part of our Christmas holiday trying to find Soviet soldiers to talk to, though I honestly don't know if we were going to try to befriend them, harass them, spy on them, or recruit them. We stayed in West Berlin for a few days, and because it was 2 years before the Berlin Wall was constructed, we could walk freely into East Berlin. I remember approaching a couple of uniformed Russians on the street and getting about as far as, "Hello, how are you?" before they laughed at us. At the end of our year in Munich, Mike received an appointment to the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, but I failed to secure my own placement. So in the summer of 1960, I transferred to the University of Maryland's main campus in College Park, where I enrolled in the Air Force ROTC program. Because the university is a federal land-grant college, the government required all male students to participate in ROTC during their freshman and sophomore years. Because I actually wanted to become a military officer, I also joined the Cadet Leadership Academy, the program to train cadet officers. I reapplied to all of the service academies, and that fall I finally received an alternate appointment to the U.S. Naval Academy. I took a bus from College Park to Annapolis for the physical exam, the last requirement for admission. To my profound shock, I failed the exam, in the process learning that the vision in my left eye wasn't within the standards for commissioning as an officer in any of the military services. I was devastated. I wrote my parents to let them know my plans for my life would have to change. A few days later, I received a letter back from my dad. A Marine Corps colonel who was a friend and colleague of his could pull some strings to get me into the Marine Corps Platoon Leaders Course, a commissioning program for which my deficient eye wouldn't necessarily disqualify me. And on February 2, 1961, I enlisted in the Marine Corps Reserve. I have vivid memories of the following rather unpleasant summer in Quantico, Virginia. My drill instructors, Gunny Fowler and Sergeant Stiborski, were two tough, squared-away Marines who physically and emotionally scared me. None of us college boys had a name other than Maggot. I spent seemingly endless hours on the drill grinder, the expanse of asphalt I thought might melt the soles of my boots. I can still recall the serial number of my vintage M1 rifle, 1954622, and silently pleading with it to please, please do what Sergeant Stiborski kept telling us our weapons were supposed to do. One day, Gunny Fowler said he was fed up with our drill and ceremony proficiency and was going to show us how it was supposed to be done. We were all loaded onto what, aptly, were called cattle cars, small semi-trailer trucks with no seats, and driven, standing, to the Marine Barracks at 8th and I Streets in southeast Washington to witness a Friday evening sunset parade, the ultimate in military pageantry and ceremony. I remember the first time the Marines went from the commands of port arms to attention. And when their 300 rifles hit the deck in response, there was just a single sharp crack of butt plates on concrete, rather than the flurry of clanks produced when my training platoon in Quantico executed the same drill. Their precision gave me goosebumps. All those rifles, just one sound. Half a century later, it's still thrilling to me, and I still try to attend sunset parades at the Marine Barracks at least once each year. Our training platoon had started with 52 maggots. On the final day of the course, we were down to just 35, and we still needed to pass our final grueling physical test to graduate. All 35 of us were successful, and ours was the only platoon that didn't leave someone behind. As we went back to our Quonset Hut barracks to shower and change into our clean utility uniforms, Fowler and Staborsky addressed us for the first time as Marines. I still feel the tingle of pride from that memory, and despite spending 32 years in an Air Force uniform, I continue to have a deep spiritual connection to the Corps. I wanted nothing so much as to be a Marine intelligence officer, but the Marine Corps of the 60s didn't have a viable path for an intelligence career. So I returned to College Park and Air Force ROTC for my junior year of college in the fall of 1961, and I transferred my enlistment from the Marine Corps to the Air Force Reserve. That summer, my dad had been reassigned to NSA headquarters in Maryland, and my family had returned to the States. To save money, I moved into the basement of their quarters at Fort Meade and commuted to College Park. After a summer with Gunny Fowler and Sergeant Staborsky, I was suddenly a rock star at close-order drill and professional courses, and I quickly moved up the Air Force ROTC cadet ranks. But the most momentous life event of my junior year was when my parents became reacquainted with the Terrys, a couple they'd been friends with at Vint Hill Farm Station more than a decade earlier, and my mother pressed me to reintroduce myself to their daughter, Sue, who was then a high school senior. Any recommendation on girls from my mother was an immediate turnoff for me, and my lack of interest was only compounded when I realized who she was and that she no longer had my comic books. But my mother bugged me, and finally I agreed to call Sue. I brought her down to the university campus on a Sunday afternoon to show her around. She liked it and immediately decided she was going to apply for the following fall. That was the start of a 3.5-year, stormy, on-again-off-again dating relationship. In the summer of 1962, I attended ROTC summer training for rising seniors at Otis Air Force Base in Massachusetts. After the PLC training in Quantico, Otis felt more like a Boy Scout jamboree than military training. I consider that a testament to the PLC program rather than a slight to Air Force ROTC, and with the Marine Corps experience behind me, the Air Force officer in charge simply wrote in my evaluation that I acted as if I were already commissioned. None of the training exercises at Otis was particularly memorable, but one afternoon we were quickly loaded onto buses and driven to the airfield. On the way there, we were told that President Kennedy was landing at the base en route to a family vacation at his residence in Hyannisport, and we were to make him feel welcome when he got off Air Force One. Somehow, I ended up with 8 or 10 other cadets in the front row against the rope as the president shook hands with each of us. When he got to me, I gave him my name, and he asked me what plane I wanted to fly. I told him that I didn't want to fly. I wanted to be an intelligence officer. He stopped and looked at me, a bit askance. There was just a brief pause, and then he said, "Good. "We need more like you," and moved on. I'm sure the president never gave that little exchange another thought. I'll never forget it. I received my commission to be an Air Force second lieutenant as a distinguished military graduate in June 1963. My academic and military grades had been stellar, and I'd been commandant of the Cadet Leadership Academy for the first semester of my senior year, and then Cadet Wing Commander the second semester, which meant that I was able to select the profession of intelligence officer, and I had my pick of first assignment. I selected the Signals Intelligence Officers course at Goodfellow Air Force Base in San Angelo, Texas, the Air Force SIGINT College of Knowledge. Well west of the Houston-Dallas-San Antonio triangle, San Angelo was 4 hours from any major city. There was very little to do besides studying signals intelligence, and most of us couldn't even do that right away. That summer, the Air Force didn't plan well for how to manage 60 brand-new second lieutenants all showing up at Goodfellow at the same time, most of us lacking the security clearance required to take classes. Background investigations require some time, particularly for people who've lived overseas, so most of us spent our first few months cycling through busy work assignments like Assistant Officers Club Manager. We played a lot of cards and flag football and drank a lot of beer. Bored and looking for something professionally useful to do, I found the Air Force Major who was in charge of base security and asked if I could ride along with the enlisted air police on their rounds. He looked me over. I was in my Air Force uniform, but still had the starched shirt, shiny shoes, and buzz cut of a Marine. He agreed, and so I spent the next few months working with enlisted security forces. Meanwhile, Sue was on the opposite work curve. She'd majored in partying during her freshman year at University of Maryland, and after deciding that college wasn't for her, applied for work at NSA. She first worked as an editor of technical publications, and then landed a job as a secretary in the Soviet Air Division, the gatekeeper and office manager for a group of analysts tasked with keeping tabs on Soviet air defense forces, right in the center of some of the most important intelligence work taking place at the time. Many of the prominent codecrackers of World War II had been women who'd stayed with the agency after the war, and NSA in the 1960s was appreciative of their contributions and more open to having them in leadership positions than the rest of government or corporate America. My dad had worked for several of these women in the 1950s, including Juanita Moody and Anne Caracristi, who in 1980 would shatter the glass ceiling as deputy director of NSA. Hearing him talk about these individuals as smart, capable leaders, without him making a big deal about their gender, made a bigger impression on my views of women than any feminist views my mother ever expressed. After about 5 months, my security clearance finally came through, and I started learning the professional discipline of signals intelligence. I distinctly remember the afternoon of November 22, 1963. After classes all morning, I'd eaten lunch in the base mess hall and climbed into my Corvair convertible for the short drive back to my room in the bachelor officer's quarters. I turned the radio on and heard the first reports out of Dallas that President Kennedy had been shot. As I drove, the realization of what had happened hit me. The shock, disbelief, and uncertainty. He and the First Lady were so attractive as a couple and had captured the hearts of the American people. And I'd met him just 15 months earlier. He'd shaken my hand and said we needed more people like me. On base, everything stopped. There were no afternoon classes, and we were all glued to our televisions. I felt dissociated from the reality of the moment, not a participant, but just an observer of the world, a feeling I'd have again in September 2001. And also, just as after 9/11, what followed was a combination of uncertainty, that the world had changed forever and we'd have to find a new normal, and of resolution, that the nation would move forward together. As my seminar of 13 lieutenants wrapped up our 5-month training course in early 1964, we eagerly looked forward to our assignments. The training had prepared us to be flight commanders for SIGINT units overseas, where we would supervise shifts of airmen conducting SIGINT collection around the clock. I was ready to pick up the family torch of collecting Soviet communications and doing to them what I'd done to the Philadelphia PD at the age of 12. But the Air Force, in its infinite wisdom, decided to assign me to what was euphemistically called the Air Force Special Communications Center at Kelly Air Force Base in San Antonio, a highly classified third echelon type in-depth processing and analytic organization, much like NSA. It conducted longer-term analysis on the Soviet air forces. I was appointed the deputy chief of the Soviet Air Defense Branch, a job title much more impressive than the responsibilities with which I was actually entrusted, but I set out to learn as much as I could about the technical tasks performed by the airmen I was ostensibly supervising. They seemed to appreciate my willingness to have them show me the ropes. After about 6 months, I was plucked out of that job and moved to what was known in the military as the orderly room, which is the hub of military management, inspecting barracks, the mess hall, and the motor pool, administering personnel actions, discipline, and reenlistment ceremonies, and on and on. I served, for example, as a summary court officer in the case of an airman killed in a bar fight, and dealt with his personal effects and settled affairs with his family. The most indelible experience I had was processing the dishonorable discharges of two airmen who were roommates in the barracks and who had been outed, which was not a term used back then, as homosexual. In the day, there was, by regulation, no other recourse. They automatically lost their security clearances and were expelled from the service. At best, homosexuals were given general discharges. Some received dishonorable. These two individuals were model airmen, superb Russian linguists, meticulous about their military responsibilities, and devoted to serving their country. I remember thinking what a waste of talent it was, in addition to being a profound injustice, and it viscerally bothered me that I was forced to play a part in their unceremonious dismissals. I was very happy to escape back to Fort Meade to visit my parents for the Christmas holidays, with the bonus of meeting up with Sue, whom I hadn't seen much of that year. We shared so many things, our values, our experiences as military brats, our love of country and appreciation for the intelligence mission. And truthfully, there was a spark between us that transcended any difficulties we'd had in the past. I went to the Hecht Company department store and bought an engagement ring for $165. Sue still wears that ring and still remembers how much it cost. I went back to Texas for a few months as Sue and our mothers made plans for the wedding, and in April 1965 we were married in the Post Chapel at Fort Meade, and our wedding was big, happy, and attended by many in the business, as our families were both well known in the NSA community. We counted driving back to Texas as our honeymoon, and in San Antonio we moved into a small apartment and began our journey through life together. Sue got a secretarial job with a small NSA detachment that had just formed at Kelly Air Force Base, the distant predecessor of what's now the huge and hugely important NSA Texas facility at Joint Base San Antonio-Lackland. Once again, she was doing important work in support of intelligence operations, while I wasn't doing much with my recent training and years of preparation. I started taking night classes at St. Mary's University, working toward a master's degree, which was a crucial professional accomplishment in the 1960s Air Force. Meanwhile, the U.S. presence in Southeast Asia was ramping up. After the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964, an exchange of fire between North Vietnamese patrol boats and a U.S. Navy destroyer conducting signals intelligence operations in which both sides took damage and several North Vietnamese sailors died, Congress authorized military action. In 1965, more than 200,000 combat troops were shipped to the theater, and I volunteered for a one-year tour. I arrived at Tan Son Nhut Air Base outside Saigon in December 1965 as one of the first 100 Air Force intelligence officers to go to Vietnam.